So you may notice that before every teisho, there's a period of silence, just like tonight. And that is the very essence of what the root of any teisho is about. And I'm going to talk about that tonight. So, in this silence, something's happening. What's happening? There are sounds, there are sensations, thoughts coming through, feeling of your body on the cushion, moment after moment after moment, which here, in this place, this incredible place where we all meet and do this thing that we call Zazen, we delve into that in detail, and that is called Zazen, sitting absorption. Now, I could give you many kinds of teisho about various koan and everything else, but it all boils down to this one thing. So we might as well just go again back to the very root. I think that's helpful at this point without getting into too many complications. So I mentioned before, this is the last teisho I gave, some of you weren't here, a quote from the Diamond Sutra, which are the words of the Buddha. And this particular quote was one that the sixth patriarch, Wei Nung, when he was collecting firewood, he was very poor, he was a young man collecting firewood for his mother, and he was illiterate. And there were some Buddhist monks that were walking by. And he stopped and he heard them chanting the Diamond Sutra, and actually there was one line that he heard. And this line, when he heard it, precipitated an awakening. He woke up to the truth. And the line was, as we mentioned before, develop a mind that abides nowhere. Which I feel is the very root, the very essence of what our practice is, developing a mind that abides nowhere, that gets stuck nowhere, that stops nowhere, that if it doesn't stop and doesn't get stuck, what does it do? This is a flowing mind, like a river, continually, moment after moment after moment, never getting stuck. And if it does get stuck, that too is flowing. Now, we didn't go into this too much. What happens when that mind gets, and I'll put it in quotes, stuck? When the mind gets stuck on an idea, on a feeling, fighting something, struggling with something, rejecting something, all of those things. What happens then? We notice it. Just notice it. Don't fight with it. Don't struggle against it. Because that just continues this sleepy-minded turning it into an entity that you're opposing, and then you become an entity opposing it. But the minute you notice something happening, it again gets unstuck. When you actually look right at it, anything, a feeling, a pain, a worry, an anger, a jealousy, whatever it might be, when you look at it, examine it, just like you do anything else, any neutral thing in Zazen, what do you notice? You notice that it continually is changing. From moment to moment to moment, it never stays the same. And as you begin to get curious about it, as I've said before, instead of being anxious about it, pushing it away, fighting it, strategizing over it, if you just take that anxiety and you turn it just slightly, just a little angle, turn it from anxiety to curiosity. Get curious about it. What is it? Look right at it. Don't be afraid of it. Then you see it's continually changing. It's actually part of the river. Now, it was there because of causes and conditions. which are interconnected to the entire fabric of space and time. Time meaning the whole flow of events from the Big Bang till now. And space meaning no separation between the events occurring anywhere and anywhere else. It's all interacting. Nothing happens anywhere that doesn't affect the whole. There's nothing isolated from this whole. And you yourself are not isolated from this whole. Although it feels sometimes that you are. Sometimes it feels that there's a little entity inside peering out at a world that's spinning and going on outside. So when you look at these things that we tend to fight against or look away from, that's that third poison, ignoring, we realize that they're flowing like a river too. So nothing can stop your river. Nothing. With that attitude of mind. No pain, no worry, no concern, no belief about yourself. A belief comes up. A repeating thought, something that's troubled you for a long time, it keeps coming back. Every time it comes back, you just watch it, just observe it, and notice that it's changing, and that it's not separated from everything else. There's that, and there's the sound of the fan, there's the feeling of your knees on the zabaton, the sensations in the body. All of these things are happening at once. They're all constantly changing and moving. This is the unstuck mind, the non-abiding mind. Now, we use the term mind. What do we mean by mind? What do we mean by mind? Ordinarily, we mean this thing standing apart. The mind is the thing that hears, the thing that feels. The thing that knows, the thing that understands, the thing that moves my arms and legs, the thing that makes decisions. So we sense that this mind is actually an entity. There's something there. It's there. The mind is there. It's not all those other things. It's not the river. It's what knows the river. And that is called the abiding mind. And when Wei Nun heard that monk say, develop a mind that abides nowhere, and had his awakening, that is what he got. He got what the mind really is. He got it. What is this mind? If we look at it, we try to find it, what do we find? First, you know, on the superficial level, we found sensations and thoughts. And then when we go deeper, we have a sense of something that we have called me. Me is the thoughts, and I know these thoughts. So the mind starts to get more subtle. And that's me. But that's still an object. There's nothing that you can find all the way down that if you tried to find this mind would not eventually be an object of the mind, of what we believe is the mind. There's nothing that you could possibly find to identify this thing that you call mind that is not an object of mind. So you can't find it. I don't care how long and how hard you look. And in our Zen practice, particularly with koan, we do exactly that. We go to the rock bottom. It's very, very important to do that, to totally get it all the way down. Because as long as there's a belief that there's an entity there, even though I don't know exactly what it is, that is still abiding. It's abiding in a belief. There's all sorts of beliefs that people abide in. One of the beliefs is that there's someone up there in the sky that's pulling the strings. Never seen this thing. Maybe you have sensed it, but it's a belief. There's a belief there's something inside. So people often pride themselves, Buddhists pride themselves that I don't have that belief. I don't believe there's an entity apart from creation that made everything and is pulling all the strings. I don't believe that. But if I were really honest and clear about it, really got it, I'd realize I believe in something else that I can't find. I believe in an entity inside that I call me or mind, separate from everything, observing, hearing, seeing. I've never found it, but I believe in it. So that's a belief. And that's the abiding mind. So we talked before about how this mechanism of getting stuck or abiding, same word really, getting stuck, how does it happen? One way is to hold on to something that is transient, which is everything. Everything is transient. Everything is impermanent. But to hold on to it, to cling, to hold on to it, so that's a stuck mind. It's got to constantly change, but I'm holding on to that idea, that desire to keep something going, to have more of something that I really like. This is, we all understand this. The other is to push away something that is there inevitably. Now, what is there inevitably? Everything is here inevitably in this moment. There's nothing that is not inevitable in this moment, meaning the world comes as an absolute. It can't be compared to anything. The way it is right now had to be this way. Therefore, it was inevitable. And yet, if there's something that I can't accept, that I push against, that I push away, then I've misunderstood that and I'm stuck fighting it. And that's an abiding mind. And the third one is ignoring, which can be partly not seeing at all, turning away, not being aware of this river flowing, staying in some stuck place and not being aware of the actual flow of the moment. For example, I quoted, it was either Ronald Reagan or the older George Bush, making the single most stupid comment ever made by any human being in all of time, which is, if you've seen one redwood, you've seen them all. So when this person who said that sees a redwood, they're not seeing the redwood, they're ignoring the redwood. What they're seeing is their idea of a redwood. They're not seeing this person, this flowing river, this step down the sidewalk, this unique drive to work, not like any other drive I ever made to work. It's a unique drive to work because every moment is unique and every moment is now. But when I ignore, I get stuck in an idea. And the most pernicious ideas are the beliefs. Beliefs that, you know, people of this color are thus and such, people of this religion are thus and such. And the deeper beliefs that there's an entity inside, peering out through my eyes, experiencing the world. There is a separate thing that I have a name for, which I call me. So that's ignoring. So what happens when the mind gets unstuck? What happens? We all already know this because we have done it tonight. And every time we sit down on the cushion and do zazen, we already know we have unstuck our minds. Our minds are unstuck in that moment. We're not operating by a map. We're not pushing anything away. We're not holding on to anything. We're not ignoring the flow of the moment-to-moment experience of being in zazen. And hopefully we're not engaging in a belief. What are we doing? One. Two. Three. Or whatever it might be. That's the river. That is the river. So when we had that silence before we started talking tonight, we were doing it. As I sometimes say, we were walking the walk. It's important to have a grasp of Buddhism and understand the direction we need to point, pull the rug out from under beliefs. All sorts of talks like this can help, books can help, teishos can help. But we have to walk the walk. And we all know what it's like now to have an unstuck mind. That is the non-abiding mind. So we experience the non-abiding mind while we're on the cushion. But what about in our day-to-day life? We have to remind ourselves not to get stuck anywhere. As that old man at the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting said to this young woman who told me about it, he said to her over and over when she brought up all these things she was struggling with, don't let it stop you. But it says, don't let it stop you. I know, but then I said, don't let it stop you. And then she said to me, and then I got it. What'd you get? Don't let it stop me. Don't let it stop me. So in our day-to-day life, off the cushion, we remind ourselves, don't stop anywhere. Don't abide anywhere. Keep flowing. Keep flowing. Don't create an idea of yourself, an idea of the situation that is a stuck idea. It's important to have your maps, but we hold them very lightly. Realize there's a real world flowing here. It doesn't totally match this idea I have of it, which would be, if you've seen one redwood, you've seen them all. But I'm not interested in that view of the world. It's a dead view of the world. It's an inept view of the world. It's a view of the world that hurts others and myself. So what I do, if, for example, I'm working on the koan mu, is I bring up that koan mu, immediately unsticking me. Immediately I'm in the river again. Because, as is true, mu is everything. So anything you're doing can be mu. Whatever you're doing is mu. Looking at your watch is mu. Driving a car is mu. Talking to your friend is mu. The reason to remind yourself at that moment is simply to unstick your mind. Because on the cushion, when it's moo, you are in that river. You're flowing. You have a non-abiding mind. Nothing fancy about it. In your day-to-day life, this is how you bring your practice into your day-to-day life, in order to unstick your mind. If you have a breath practice, you don't watch your breath while you're doing this and that. You simply allow it to happen. You become one with it. And this is what you would do both on the cushion and off the cushion if you have a practice called Shikantaza, which is the most pure form of flowing river. Shikantaza. No other object except this actual moment as it is, flowing, alone. No one watching it. It flows by itself. It doesn't need a watcher. It doesn't need to lean on a crutch called me. It doesn't need that. That's Shikantaza. So breath practice and Shikantaza off the cushion are just. When walking, just walking. Just like we do Kinhin, just walking. Feel your hands here, you notice your balance. Feel the foot on the floor, things moving. Attentive mind, thought comes in, that's fine. Thought doesn't stop the river. Thought's there too. Thought flows, I notice the thought. I didn't get caught by the thought. I didn't get stuck on the thought. I didn't fight the thought. I didn't allow the thought to create an idea, a belief about an entity inside and how rotten it is, how much it lacks, or anything like that. I just know, oh, there's that thought walking, okay? Exactly how we conduct ourselves in our day-to-day life. That's being a hidden monk. That's being a true Zen student, to be very attentive in each moment. Non-abiding. But again, I'll come back to this question. What is that mind? What is it? masters have said various things about it. One of the most beautiful things said about it was said by Dogen. One thing he said is, mind is none other than mountains and rivers and the great wide earth, the sun, the moon, and the stars. Is that not the river mind? Mind is none other than mountains and rivers, redwoods, rotting garbage, squirrel running across the street, sound of the fan in the background. None other than that. There's nothing outside of that rotting garbage the moment that you smell it. There's nothing outside it. You're not standing outside it. You're flowing. You're not abiding. You're not abiding in a me, in a separate entity. Dogen just put it out plainly. He didn't make it abstruse. He said, mind is none other than mountains and rivers and the great wide earth, the sun, the moon, and the stars. And there's a beautiful koan. This is a lovely, wonderful koan. And I'll read it. So, a monk once said to Daryo Osho, who's a master, the physical body decomposes. What is the indestructible Dharmakaya, which means literally body of truth? But you could say, what is this indestructible mind with a capital M that I've been searching for so hard, that all these great people have awakened to? What is it? And Daryo answered, blooming mountain flowers are like golden brocade. Brimming mountain waters are blue as indigo. Mountains and rivers. Where is there an entity there? Where is there a me there? Blooming mountain flowers are like golden brocade. Brimming mountain waters are blue as indigo. We're probably walking down a lovely springtime path in the mountains when the question was asked. What more could you say? This is the non-abiding mind. It's very, very simple. It's not complicated. There's nothing to figure out. As I said before, mu is not an idea. If mu was an idea, you'd have to try to figure it out. It'd be a puzzle. It's not an idea. Mu is the river. You have to enter it fully with your whole mind and body. You jump in the river, and then you don't know where your mind and body ends and the water begins. And that is called the non-abiding mind. Now, I could, in order to fill time, continue to talk and create a lot of unnecessary noise. But I gave it to you as straight as I can give it, as basic, as to the root as I could possibly give it. So I'm going to end there and open it up if there's any comments or questions. And if there aren't, that's fine. You can just sit in the river.
I always assume that the silence, the stellar tissue, really was for the benefit of the teacher, who in fact was waiting for the tissue to flow.
Mm-hmm. That's true too.
Okay.
And why would that be a benefit? Because to sit here in front of what I feel are superb Zen students, last week I called you guys professionals. I view you like the riders in the Tour de France that I emulate. There are no better Zen students on earth than right here in this room. To sit in front of them with nothing prepared and talk from your heart about something so important, something so ineffable, almost can't be put into words, it has to come from that river. So you're exactly right. You're exactly right. And sometimes it doesn't come out that easy. Sometimes it's not that easy to do it. Sometimes you're tired, sometimes you're distracted, because you're a human being. And that's important, because it doesn't matter if you're a teacher, a student, whatever it is you name yourself, in order to remove yourself from the river and put a label on something that isn't really there. Whatever it is at that moment couldn't have been otherwise, and you might as well just wrap your arms around it. Might as well just embrace it. Why pretend it isn't there? Why fight it? You know, it's there for a reason. And over time, all of us have, I'm sure, noticed this, that over time with your practice, you soften around these things. You're less hard on yourself. And at the same time, you're less hard on the people you love. They don't have to be so perfect, meaning my idea of perfect, which is another way of my mind getting stuck, another way of abiding. I'm abiding in an idea of what perfect is. So the Buddha said there are three marks of existence. He said dukkha, anatta, anicca. Dukkha, no self, impermanence. But let's look at the first one, dukkha. Everything is dukkhic. Everything. In other words, nothing matches my idea of perfection, my map of perfection. Everything's imperfect. So what I'll sometimes say to folks is, your true nature comes disguised as something imperfect. It's disguised. It's hiding from you in the form of something imperfect, in the form of something lacking. Something in pain, something depressed, something suffering. Your true nature comes that way. But because you are stuck on an idea of perfection, you don't see it. Which is why Yaiko Iwasaki, and I quoted her last week, on her deathbed, dying of TB, a frail 27-year-old Japanese female, couldn't even sit up to do zazen, but had this series of profound awakenings. Because her faith was so deep and she sat so hard in the position she could sit in, she wrote to Harada Roshi and said, what a relief to discover that just as I am perfect. Just as I am. She saw that. My true nature comes disguised as something imperfect, something lacking, something dying, something not fully together. Something damaged, whatever it might be, whatever these ideas are that arise in the mind, because we have the human condition, we're human beings. So part of this practice, as we unstick our mind, we develop this non-abiding mind, is really softening up, not being so hard on ourselves. Now, I can tell you personally that in my Zen practice, when I was young, I was very, very hard on myself. I didn't understand that. I still had an idea that there was some perfect state, some perfect mind state, some perfect being. I could not possibly be awakened. I'm too imperfect. You know, the Buddha was perfect. All these ideas that I had, and I was extremely hard on myself and hard on people I loved. And things softened up later on in my practice when I started to get a little smart about it. So that's another way of unsticking yourself. Anyone else? Anything. You don't have to be embarrassed or shy or anything. Just any idea that came up as a result of anything I said.
When you mention the abiding mind, I equate that with the identity of self or the ego. And it brought me to a comment I heard attributed to a Zen practitioner, Roshi. I don't know who it was, but the question was asked, how much ego do we need to live in the world? And I think the response was something along the lines of, just enough not to step out on the street in front of a car. And I just wanted to put that out there for you to comment on.
So the question, just to repeat it for the microphone, which may not have heard it, is the questioner asked that he always believed that the non-abiding mind was something about letting go of ego. And yet, in order to function in the world, we need to have some ego. And a Roshi once said, you just need enough ego to avoid stepping out in front of a car, which I think is true. Mm-hmm. But let's not call that ego so much as a map, a structure in your mind. We have to have structures in order to survive. And the structure is deeply, deeply learned. And oftentimes will overlie the world like a tight skin and we can't see through it. So part of the practice here is not to destroy the map, but to be able to pick it up when we need it and put it down when we no longer need it. I think that's a little more subtle way of looking at it. Now, ego, in terms of a good feeling about yourself, so you don't have to doubt yourself in every moment, and you don't have to become what one person referred to as morbidly self-infatuated, because you're constantly criticizing yourself and trying to make yourself better in the eyes of others, which is the human condition as well, and is familiar to every human being at some point or other in their life, and perhaps many times in their life. That, so to have some sense of you're okay, I'm okay. You know, and it may be that I'm okay just the way I am, exactly like Yaku Iwasaki. So that's a healthy ego, to say that just as I am, I'm okay. I'm okay. I don't have to be my idea, my map, my image of perfect. And the things in me that are lacking, that are selfish, that are at times hurtful, at times jealous, at times angry, they all were there for a reason, and I was not in control of those reasons. Many of those reasons happened even outside my awareness. So I can now be very gentle and put my arms around myself. So when I put my arms around myself, being fully aware of my lacking and my feelings, wanting to be a better person, and watching my behavior and my thoughts, that's creating a more healthy ego. So on that end, yes. But is there any need to continually stand apart from the world and believe that there's an entity inside, looking out through my eyes, hearing things? No need for that. If you want it, you can carry it around. But there's no need for it. It's like that koan, the student said, you know, I'm struggling with this feeling of being separate, and he said, put it down. Put it down. Put it down. You don't need it. If you want it, you can carry it. He said, well, carry it with you. If you want it, carry it. And if you're going to carry it, then carry it. Don't struggle with it. Don't fight it. Just pick it up and carry it. I'm a human being. Right now, I feel hurt. That's okay. I couldn't be otherwise. I'm carrying it. I'm not going to get stuck fighting it, which is the abiding mind. So it gets subtle. Get subtle, but I can tell you that even though it arises, the sense of being separate as an ego, you don't need it. It's not necessary to live in the world. Any other questions? These are wonderful, wonderful comments. Yes?
Just on the same point, I find that my experience that there's, you know, I will say it's okay to not have that ego or that entity that I'm carrying around, but then my mind always just kind of slips behind and says, well, replace it with what? Mm-hmm. And then it's like replace it with this, replace it with that, or is it this, is it that? And it's always searching for something to mm-hmm. land on mm-hmm. continually.
Right.
And it's almost like the non-abiding mind is looking for something to abide in continuously and without stopping that activity.
Right.
So there's no peace in it.
Exactly. You know? Well, you're a very experienced Zen student. You've done deep practice. And you get to a place where the ego starts to fight back. It's just afraid of going all the way. It's afraid of it. Like, what would be left? Like, what would I be? It tries to find something. You know you're not your neuroses. You know you're not your, you know, thoughts. But can I really not be there at all? If I wasn't there as an entity standing apart, what would I be? Now, to answer that question, you have to go to the rock bottom. So working on a koan, you have to go all the way down. Now, that may happen only during certain times when you can set aside a period of time to really go very, very deep into it. And oftentimes fear arises. There's a holding on, there's a fear, sometimes a panic. Your heart will pound like crazy. You just, oh my God, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm either going to become enlightened, die, or go crazy. One of the three. And I only have one chance out of three of something good happening. That's the belief. It's like Russian roulette. But, you know, this is what it requires sometimes to break through. And other times, it just happens. Just happens. Can't explain it. Just all of a sudden you understand that mind is no other. And it doesn't have to require this profoundly deep going to the rock bottom. It can, maybe you did that, maybe you did deep practice, and one day it just opens up. Mind is no other than mountains and rivers and the great wide earth, the sun, the moon, and the stars. I got it. You'll forget it, but you get it back. Comes and goes. You find what comes back is the feeling of me. Right? The feeling of me. The feeling of me is deeply learned. It's deeply habitual. But all you have to do then is say, this feeling of me, how's that hearing? How can a feeling of me hear? How can a feeling of me see? Because I'm aware of that feeling of me. I named it. I sense it. So something that I'm sensing can't be hearing that sound. That's just an object of mine. It can't be a subject. Can't be. So just feel your me right now. Feel this sense of me. That's the object of something. Something. That object can't hear. So what is hearing? This was the question that Basui asked profoundly. What is hearing that sound? What is hearing it? All the way down to the rock bottom. And he said, no matter how hard you look, you will not find an entity called me. He came right out and told the students that. But you have to look because you still think it's there. And that's part of this abiding mind. Okay? And it's important to get pointed in a direction, but each of us has to walk on our own. Even if someone were to try to explain it completely in the most perfect language, you still wouldn't get it that way. Can't. Because it would end up being a picture in your mind. And a picture can't hear. A picture can't see. So what is it that's doing that? Any other questions? You're actually just about out of time. Yes?
I just got kind of the pure relentlessness of a sense of self. It's like an optical illusion. You kind of measure the two lines and say, no, they're the same, but your eyes think they're not.
Right.
You know, and then the sense of self is that, you know, I know I have no self. I know there is no self, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, day-to-day life, it keeps getting in there.
Mm-hmm. What's better than saying, I know I don't have a self, is to look at what it seems to be. Look right at it. All right. So rather than say, I don't have it, examine it. Find out what that actually is. Okay? The other one is using the thinking mind to try to figure it out. When you look right at it, right into the heart of it, you're using your zazen that you've trained yourself so hard to do. This absorption, this observing, this diligent mindfulness to find out. Okay? That's the core of our practice. It's not philosophy. All right, we'll end there tonight.